Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. We have a full lineup of guests this hour, starting in just a moment, and he has a brand new book, General Colin Powell. It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership is the name of the book, and he addresses kindness, leadership, terrorism, student exchange programs, make work, hot dogs, how he became one of the City College of New York's greatest sons, how we are touched by the people we meet during the course of our lives, and he'll be with us momentarily. Later this hour, the Second Lady of the United States, Jill Biden, will be with us. Don't forget, God Bless Our Troops is the name of her children's book. And still later this hour, we'll talk with a Vietnam vet who was honored by the White House in May. He has set up a number of coffee houses in the Midwest in which vets can go to have social support and also have peer mentoring. So it's a full hour. Your phone calls are welcome, of course, during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can go to our Facebook page to leave messages as well, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. General Colin Powell, a retired four-star general in the United States Army who served four presidential administrations in a variety of roles, most recently, of course, as Secretary of State from 2001 to 2005, is our guest this hour, or not this hour, but he'll be with us for the first half hour of our program. His new book, which is really a delight, is It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership. General Powell, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Well, thank you very much, Kathleen, and I'm so pleased to share the hour with Jill Biden and Bob Curry, who are doing such terrific things, and your summary of the book was excellent.
Thank you. We have a pretty good lineup of guests this hour, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would say indeed.
Yeah, not bad. I want to start, and then we won't talk about it the rest of the hour, but everybody's asking you this, and in your book, you talk about the case against Iraq, so let's just take that on right at the beginning before we talk about other things. You're asked about it, you said, almost every day. It was, you write, by no means your first, but it was one of your most momentous failures, the one with the widest-ranging impact. You try to get over failure quickly. We need to learn from it. What questions remain in your mind, General Powell, and how have you been able to move on from that?
Well, the questions that remain in my mind are the rhetorical questions I put in the book, and that is, how did this actually happen? How did our large intelligence organization, 16 different agencies, tens of billions of dollars, how did they miss the fact that some of the sources were so bad and should have been known, and some people didn't know it? So there have been several large investigations of it, but I've never been satisfied in my own mind as to how some of this information crept into our analyses. And the other point I have to make is that my presentation to the UN was the most visible and vivid demonstration of our intelligence case. But it wasn't really what said we would go to war or not. The president had already decided before I went to the UN that military action would be necessary. And 4 months before I went to the UN, the Congress had passed by an overwhelming number a resolution giving the president the authority for that. And we all were using that same base of information. The Congress had received the National Intelligence Report. The president had received it. We were all sort of saying the same thing. But my presentation was the most memorable one, and that's why I get asked about it every day. But I tried to do the best I could in presenting what the intelligence community believed was the case. Mm-hmm. I wasn't misled. Nobody lied. This is what they believed the case was. It turned out that they were incorrect in some aspects of it, and I'm not sure that I fully understand why those aspects were not seen at the time. But I get asked about it every day, and I have to answer it the way I just did.
Yeah. In another part of the book, you say that before we invaded Iraq, we should have listened to more people with ground truth experience in the region. These people were out there, and fewer idea-heavy big egos in Washington. There is a lot in that sentence. Let's start with ground truth experience. Are there a lot of people who are giving us ground truth experience, and are we underutilizing them?
Well, I'll give you the most direct, perfect example of that. General Shinseki, who was chief of staff of the Army at the time, was up before a congressional hearing, and he was asked by a senator, how many troops do you think it would take to stabilize this country after the regime is removed. And he said a couple of 100,000. And the next day, he was immediately criticized and his opinion shot down by the Secretary of Defense and the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And you didn't hear any more about Rick Shinseki. But he was right. And some of the previous commanders of the Central Command, thinking about that problem, had always thought it would take a large number of troops to stabilize the country. But there were others in the administration and in the intellectual world who said, nope, just take out the regime and suddenly the Iraqis will rise up, create a new government, and it'll all be fine in a few months. And we stuck with that for a long time. Insurgency broke out, just as had been predicted by some. And we didn't respond to that insurgency until almost 3 years later when President Bush finally ordered the surge. And by then, the country was an absolute mess with internecine warfare taking place between the Sunnis and the Shias and Al-Qaeda and everybody else mixed up in it. And so a number of us at the beginning thought you needed to make sure that if you broke this country, you own it and you have responsibility for its security and the security of the people until you can turn it over in a sensible way.
Mm-hmm. You have been involved in hearings looking at the terrorist problem in the world some years ago. I know you're not Secretary of State anymore, but you read a lot and you know more than most of us about this. What's your assessment of the terrorist problem right now? Is it much less than when you were Secretary of State? Do we have a handle on it?
I think it's much less. Al-Qaeda has been very, very badly damaged over the last 10 years by the policies of President Bush and the continuing of those policies, for the most part, by President Obama. They're hiding. They can't go up on radios or telephones. They can't be very visible. Our intelligence community, our law enforcement people, our drones, our military forces have really got them under pressure. It doesn't mean that they have been destroyed, but they haven't been able to pull off anything like they pulled off in 9/11. So I think we're a lot safer. My one concern is that we don't become so obsessed with safety and anti-terrorism activities that we start to shut ourselves down. We make it harder for people to come visit us, send their kids to our schools, or that we become so terrorist-oriented that it becomes a terrorist industrial complex and we overspend on protecting ourselves. So you have to have the right balance. The biggest thing we have going for us is we're an open, democratic nation, and we welcome the world to come here. And if we ever lose that, then the terrorists win.
Do you think we are overspending on protecting ourselves?
I think there is a danger in that. We are spending an enormous amount of money on homeland security, and a lot of it is well spent, and we need it. But I think we have to be a little careful and make sure that we use a little appetite suppressant, because these things tend to sort of get a life of their own, and money keeps flowing to it because every community wants their share of whatever money is out there, and Congress has not been reluctant to fund these programs. And so while I'm all for protecting ourselves, and I don't resent at all going through security at airports, and I do it all the time just like any other citizen, I think we have to be a little careful and start to find ways to open ourselves up more while at the same time protecting ourselves. It's just a matter of finding the right balance.
Mm-hmm. I love the stories in the book that show what a human being you are and what your values are. I'm glad you remembered and jotted down some of those stories, because there are many acts of human kindness in this book, and that's what it's all about, isn't it? Human kindness, and you write about kindness.
I talk about kindness. I talk about optimism. I talk about getting along with people. I talk about leading people in a human way, but at the same time having high standards, and at the same time making sure that you get the job done. And also disciplining people when you have to. I don't think we have enough of that in the country right now, Kathleen. We seem to be spending a lot of time shouting and screaming at each other. We have always been a fractious nation, and our politics has always been, a contact sport. But we seem to be losing the ability to reach across to each other and find compromise, even though we feel strongly about things. And the media tends to push us in this direction with blogs and cable shows that focus on reinforcing what you already believe rather than giving you a different point of view. And frankly, that's why stations such as NPR play such an important role in our public dialogue, to remind us that, you know, we're all Americans. We may disagree, but we're all Americans, and we got to keep this country moving. And the theme of the book is, I think, in that vein. Argue, feel strongly about what you believe in, but we got to find a way to move forward, and that takes compromise.
Right. And sometimes you do the unexpected. I love the story of going to of hot dogs. Hot dogs, yep, play a role in this book, and you're walking down the streets, and you love the hot dogs in New York. Tell us the story of the then Vice President of the People's Republic of China and how you made the human connection with him via hot dogs.
Hu Jintao, who is now the president of China, several years ago was the vice president, and he made his first trip to the United States, and he was being very, very careful about what he said to make sure he stayed close to the government talking points. And so I had to entertain him as Secretary of State, and the meetings were pretty stilted. And so in order to sort of see if I can get beyond that, I asked him how he enjoyed his trip to New York, and he told me all about the meetings that he had. And I said, well, did you do anything else? Did you go to any shows? No time for that. I said, well, then you went to New York, but you didn't see New York. So next time you're here, you let me know, and we'll forget about all the meetings, and you and me and our wives will go to shows, we'll walk around, we'll go to the Bronx Zoo, and we'll stop in a corner and have a hot dog from one of the pushcart peddlers, immigrant pushcart peddler. And he looked at me curiously, and they all started translating what I was saying. And he laughed, and then he became president of China. And I've seen him several times since that conversation, and every time he spots me in a room, even now that I'm retired and just a guy in the back of the room eating dinner, he will insist that his staff bring me over to him, and he'll shake my hand, we'll have a slight gentlemanly embrace, and then he'll push me back somewhat and says, when do we do hot dogs? So he's never forgotten it. And the whole point of that story is not so much about hot dogs. It's about finding a human connection between two people who have to do work together. And I always try to find some kind of bond that is outside of the formal bond, but says to the other person, hey, I like you. Let's work together. I will try to see your position anytime I can. Please try to see my position, and then we'll get things done. Hmm. And I have found that that works for me.
And does some of that, General Powell, come from the way that you have gone through life? You didn't go to the West Point. You didn't go to all those elite Ivy League places, which everybody assumes that you did. And I think it's funny that you say, I'm a proud graduate of the City College of New York in Harlem. I mean, there is something different about you.
I was raised as a street kid in the Bronx with no particular ambition driving me as a kid. I was raised in a very diverse culture. We had blacks, whites, Eastern Europeans, Jews, Hispanics, you name it, in my street in the Bronx. I mean, there was a United Nations right in that street. And I had cousins and aunts and uncles, and so I was raised in this melting pot of people. And so I left that and went into the Army and met West Pointers and people from much more prominent schools. But just that New York background gave me an opportunity to appreciate other cultures because I probably had been raised with that other culture. And so I always tried to be, you know, a guy who reaches out to others, hey, how you doing? You know, kind of remember Mayor Koch used to say, hey, how am I doing? Or how you doing? So I'm still a New York street kid, even though I'm a soldier and a diplomat and all the rest of it. I never forget that my background is very, very humble, and humility is not a bad trait to continue to have as you go through life.
And your city, you say, believe that kids like you deserved a shot at the top. Isn't that true for people?
But just think, Kathleen, immigrant parents, I went to public school from kindergarten all the way through college. Kindergarten to college, and I have every report card from kindergarten to college, and we didn't pay anything for it, not a nickel. Why? Because the taxpayers of the city of New York and the governments of the city of New York and the state of New York said, no, we have got to educate all of our kids, and not just those who can afford it, all of them. And so they invested in their school system, and they picked up the bill for it. My goodness, shouldn't we be doing that everywhere? Those who can afford to go to the preeminent schools in the country, fine. But that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be preeminent schools for those who can't afford to go there. And we're starting to lose that a little bit. We seem to be unwilling to pay the bill for a quality education. But the other coin, the other half of that coin in quality education, is what we do in our homes and families. If we don't sort of bring youngsters into a family that is loving, where the child can see caring parents and caring relatives and caring people in his life, coaches and ministers and whatnot, then the school system can't fix that deficiency, and the kid's going to be in trouble.
General Colin Powell is our guest, and his new book, It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership, is the focus of our conversation. We go to your phone calls momentarily. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email if you'd like, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Later this hour, Second Lady of the United States, Jill Biden, on her children's book, Don't Forget, God Bless Our Troops. The second hour of our show today, we'll talk about the elections in Greece. General Colin Powell is with us now, and we have time for a few phone calls. Let's go to Boyd in Milwaukee first. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen, and hello to you, General Powell.
How are you, Boyd?
It's a pleasure to talk with you, and I want to thank you for your service. My question is this. I see, as I think we all can agree, the world is in a major phase of change, and I think the United States is in a major phase of change, whether it be domestically, but certainly internationally in its place in the world. My question to you is, where do you think the role of the military will serve in the future? I personally see a huge scaling back, maybe even a lot of the bases closed throughout Europe, for multiple reasons, but I think one is that I really just don't think over the long term this country can afford to sustain all these bases, and we need to really sort of bring the troops home and sort of do a little bit of reshuffling. Your thoughts?
Yeah, the Army is and the other services are forever going through this process. When I was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff 20-something years ago, and the Soviet Union went away, and the Warsaw Pact went away, and I was sitting there with 330,000 troops in Europe, and I called all the chiefs together and said, guys, it's over. The Cold War is over. That enemy is gone. We have to realign ourselves. We brought home almost 270,000 troops from Europe, closed many, many bases, in the United States, and released 500,000 soldiers overall from our active force. I think it is the responsibility of the military leadership to constantly be looking at what do we really need. We should not have anything more in our budget that we really don't need, but we should not have anything less than we do need. And so I think a realignment is taking place. I've been talking to some of my successors in the military. They understand it, and they're watching what might happen to their budget next year if the sequestration kicks in, or even if it doesn't kick in. And how can we close more bases? Anything that is not necessary and is costing a lot of money, we ought to get rid of. I'm a firm believer in what Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution said about the Army, and that is raise and support them when you need them. And when you don't need a large army, you should reduce it to what you do need.
Thanks, Boyd, so much for your call. Jim in La Crosse is next. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a great deal
Hi, Jim.
Respect.
Yep.
Good morning. I have a great deal of respect for you. My question is, all politics aside, how do you feel President Obama is doing?
I think he's done some things rather well. You have to sort of go back to where we were when he came into office. The country was at the edge of a financial cliff, and we stabilized the financial system. It is on a sound basis. I still think we have a big debate taking place with respect to how much regulation is needed. We want enough regulations so that the financial system works well, but at the same time not so much that we're sort of affecting our capitalist system. And the president's trying to find that right balance. But the system is stable. We saved the auto industry. We have, unfortunately, not seen the economy improve as rapidly as we would like. And I think President Obama is going to have to deal with this question over the next several months before the election. With respect to foreign policy, there are critics of the president, but in reality, the Iraq war has been closed down the way President Bush had planned for it to be closed down. And the same thing, I think, will occur in Afghanistan by 2014. We helped in Libya, but did not get on the ground in Libya, and I think that worked out fine. And in Syria, I think the president's being very careful. We have to understand that the world has changed so much from my days as chairman when you were dealing with a Soviet Union before it collapsed. It made life a lot easier. But now all of these individual countries that have sprung free from tyrannical rulers or the Soviet Union, you suddenly discover there are lots of things going on within those countries that are causing disorder. But the world in general is more democratic than it's ever been before, fewer wars than ever been before, even though you wouldn't know it from watching the press. And whoever the president is, whether it's President Obama or it's President Romney, is going to find that it is not as easy to run foreign policy as it was when we had a Cold War. But I'm glad the Cold War is gone, even if it makes life a little more difficult. So I think the president has to answer to the American people as to why the economy hasn't gotten better. We have to watch Governor Romney, if I may, and see what policies he thinks would be better, and listen to what he's saying about foreign policy. And it's always been my practice throughout my life to watch both sides, measure them, measure who they'd be bringing in with them, what policies they believe in, and then make my choice as to who is ready to best serve the country, regardless of party.
And not that long ago, a number of people share the respect that our caller just said he has for you. And people, I'm sure a lot of people were saying, General Powell, you simply must run for president. I know you were flattered by that. And maybe for a little moment you thought about it.
Well, I was honored that many of my fellow citizens felt that way, but there were quite a few of them who felt otherwise, I can assure you. I heard them too. I had to think about it, but I'm not a politician. I was a soldier. I had never been in a political party, never expressed political views, because as a career soldier, you shouldn't. But now that I was not a career soldier anymore in 1995 and the book came out, I had to think about it. And I gave it a lot of consideration, and what finally did it, Kathleen, it wasn't a single morning that I woke up, put my feet on the floor, and said to myself, I really, really think this is for me. I really, really want to go out there and campaign. And it just wasn't me, and it wasn't something my family wanted to do. So we were 100% in alignment that this is not the right thing for us. But we had an obligation to continue serving the country in some way, and I did as Secretary of State, and we did, with the work we have done in youth programs through the America's Promise Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
The people ask me all the time, do you regret it? The answer is, no, I don't regret it. I think it was the right decision for me and for us, and we've continued to serve the country. There are many ways to serve this great country of ours.
And those youth programs are wonderful. I love the stories about the exchange students you brought from England to the United States. They met the president, who it was prearranged, but you changed their lives, didn't you?
Yeah. The quick story is we had an exchange program with the British, and we kept sending over these honor graduates or outstanding young people. And I said to my British colleague, Jack Straw, why don't you send over some kids who are not on the honor roll? You know, they're the ones who need it more than anything else. So he did. He sent over two kids who had troubled past. They were drug dealers and drug users and whatnot. And they had a wonderful couple of weeks with us. And then on the last day, I said, let's go look at the White House. And we went over to the White House, and I showed them the Rose Garden and whatnot. And then I said, well, let's go see if the Oval Office is empty so I can show you what the president's office looks like. And these kids, not terribly well-dressed, but they said, yeah, sure. And I had arranged it, of course, knowing that the president was in the Oval Office. And so we went to the door. I opened the door, and I said, hey, this is the Oval Office. Come on in. And so they went in, and there was President Bush. And he invited them over. He knew their background. He chatted with them, asked them if they were clean now and what drugs had done to them and whatnot. And they shared some of that, you know, and my goodness, when you're being questioned by the president. And then he simply said to them, you know, I had a dependency, too. I had an alcohol problem. And I realized that I had to get myself squared away, and I did it. And I went on and continued on in life and became president of the United States. And so, you know, you're not limited by what you've done. You're only limited by what you might do. And we then said goodbye, and I went back to my office, and I said, what'd you think of that?
What'd you think of that? Right.
Yeah, they went back to England, and they talked about it. They went on television, and I followed up with them, and they're both doing okay.
Oh, that's a great story. And the book is filled with those kinds of great stories. We have time for maybe one more phone call. This is an interesting one. It's a caller from... Oh, I'm sorry, we lost him. Oh, no. All right. Well, I'm sorry. He was calling from Bangladesh. I don't know how he found us.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
I know. We'll try to reach him again. Alan in Appleton, hi.
Hi. It's a great privilege to speak with you, Colonel. I do have one question for you, and I'm sure you get this frequently, but as far as the terrorism issue with what we have at the airports, you mentioned that, and I used to fly a lot, and... what I don't get is when terrorists, instead of getting onto planes, just walk into the lines at the airport and blow themselves up there, or blow up an Amtrak train going across the bridge, or whatever else they want to do, where do we stop where do we say we cannot possibly put any more people to do this because there's just no way of stopping it? And the other thing, which might tie into this, how do you feel about the possibility of drones covering the United States as they become more prevalent? And I'll take your response off the air. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you. Let me go to the second one first, the drones. There was a story broke last week suggesting that the EPA, of all people, were going to start monitoring all the farmland with drones. And that got everybody going, but it turns out no such program. It was one of the things we see in public life now. Somebody starts a story that's not true, and before you have a chance to say it's not true, it's gone viral. And you really can't get everybody to then accept that it's not true. And so I think that we've been using airplanes to look at our farmland to make judgments about what's being grown or not grown. I don't see anything wrong with that. And if you were to use a drone to do it, which we're not doing, it's no real different from being an airplane. It's not going to be armed. It's not going to be shooting at anybody. It's going to be looking from the air on the ground. But right now, there is no drone program. With respect to your other question, you cannot give yourself 100% protection from a terrorist attack. And in fact, most of the so-called terrorist-type attacks that we have thwarted in recent months have been homegrown guys who are not very good at it, and they keep getting caught. It's kind of, you know, it's sad that we have these kinds of people within our society, but we always have. Terrorism or violence of this kind is there. You cannot be immune to it or from it. But airplanes are rather unique, and they, you know, we have seen the people try to use airplanes for this purpose because you can get such a dramatic kill. And you can kill so many people at one time, as we saw in 9/11, that I think the security efforts that we make on our airports and our airplanes are very sensible. But I don't think you need to carry this throughout our entire society, or else, you know, we might as well just lock ourselves up behind gates and forget about it. That's not America. I don't think that's good for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, General Powell, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. I really enjoyed the book, and you should do more on how to live a good life.
Well, thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
That's a good title.
Yeah, your title is good, too. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, bye-bye.
General Colin Powell, It Worked For Me is the name of his new book, In Life and Leadership. And the book is about all of the people that have stayed in his memory and incidents, very humorous, some of them, and many of them very poignant. Along the way, his life in the military, as Joint Chiefs of Staff, as Secretary of State, as a student who wasn't a terrific student in New York in public schools, and his work with education and foreign exchange programs and the foundation that he and his wife started working with young people. It's very interesting. And in addition, it deals a lot with all of the issues that he was dealing with when he was Secretary of State. So, thanks very much to Brett Jaspers for producing and Rhonda Fanning for doing our on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have lots coming up. Dr. Jill Biden is joining us momentarily. And then the last part of our program today, a gentleman who's been honored. He's from Milwaukee. His name is Bob Curry. He's a Vietnam veteran who founded Dry Hooch in 2008. And it's a place where vets can go for just having a cup of coffee and talking to each other. They can also avail themselves of peer mentoring in these places, and they have sprung up all over the Midwest. So all of that is coming up. This interview with Dr. Biden, we had to pre-record. I'm sorry we can't take phone calls, but we figured it's worth it to talk to the Second Lady of the United States, and we thought that you would like to hear her. Jill Biden, the Second Lady of the United States, is with us now. She's a professor of English, and she holds a doctorate in education from the University of Delaware. She is a mom, of course, and a grandmother. Her husband is Vice President Joe Biden, and she has a very moving children's book that has just been released, Don't Forget, God Bless Our Troops. And we welcome her to Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Biden, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me on today.
Your son, Beau, is the Attorney General of the state of Delaware and a major in the Delaware Army National Guard. I'm sure that his service must be part of the reason that you wrote this book.
Yes, it's the story of when Beau was deployed to Iraq for a year. And what I realized as I traveled around this country was that, you know, 1% of Americans are serving in the wars, and really many Americans don't know someone in the military, or they really don't know the military experience. So I thought that as a teacher, really one of the best ways to educate was through books. And I thought I could educate adults who are reading the books as well as children who are listening to the books. So hopefully they'll see what Natalie went through in that year. It's all based on Natalie's life. Everything happened to her. And I hope after they finish reading the book, they'll think, gosh, you know, I'd like to help a military family. I'd like to get involved with this. So in the back of the book, I offer back matter that tells what kids can do or what individuals can do, what communities can do. So I do offer suggestions or organizations to connect to.
Mm-hmm. You write, of course, as you said, from the perspective of Natalie, who's 5 years old.
Yeah.
And it is a children's book. But it's interesting to me that you have gone through this as a military mother yourself. And I'd like for you to focus on the difficulty faced by military families through your eyes, what you went through.
Well, you know, it was a difficult year for the Bidens, as it is for every military family who goes through this. And I think it was the more difficult times were during the holidays, of course, at Christmas time when I looked down my Christmas table and every Biden was there but Beau. So that was a tough thing. And, of course, he, you know, his birthday or sending him his Christmas stocking that I would pack up and send to Iraq. And so I think it's things like that that were hard for me. But, you know, the community came together and supported me. I mean, people would come up to me, just strangers would come up to me and say, you know, I'm praying for your son. Our church put Beau's name in the bulletin, and people in the community would send me cards and notes. You know, a neighbor came over in Hallie's neighborhood, my daughter-in-law, and shoveled the snow for her. So, you know, there's lots of examples in the book of the ways people, you know, acts of kindness that people gave to us. So I think that's how I sort of coped with it. But there wasn't a day that went by that, you know, really a moment that Beau wasn't on my mind.
I'm sure that's true. It really speaks to this band of brothers and sisters, what you just said, doesn't mm-hmm. it? Let's talk about the unemployment rate, Dr. Biden, for veterans, which is near 13% now. The average for the rest of the country, about 8.2%. Can you address the unemployment problem for veterans and what we can do about it?
Well, you know, that's one of the things Michelle and I have been working hard to solve, as has the, you know, the entire administration. One of the things we've done is we've offered a tax credit for businesses who hire veterans, and we've worked hard at getting military spouses employed, and we've worked hard at the licensing. For instance, I'm a teacher. If I move to another state, and, you know, these military families move, you know, 5 to 10 times during a career. And we're working on getting states to accept the certification of the nurses and the doctors and the teachers and the dental assistants. So I think we're working, our administration is working hard on the unemployment problem.
Mm-hmm. We had just recently the president of the Greater Milwaukee Committee with us. It's a private sector, important civic organization here in the city of Milwaukee. And she talked about, and I think this is a good point, veterans having this phenomenal technical expertise that our private sector economy is not fully utilizing. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. You know, they are some of the best employees because they're motivated. They get the job done. They're flexible. They have a really strong, good work ethic. So they make excellent employees. And I think that many, many, many employers will attest to that. And so many of our companies have agreed to hire veterans, you know, Sears and Siemens and Home Depot. I mean, many companies have made that commitment to hire our veterans and their spouses.
Mm-hmm. The wars, as you well know, in Iraq and Afghanistan have been controversial. All wars, I guess, are in some way. While supporting the troops being important, there are those who say that we would best support them by not having any more wars. So I'm wondering what you would say to anti-war people who feel that way. As a military mom, you see it through special eyes, and as the wife of Joe Biden, the vice president.
Well, you know, one of the reasons that I was overjoyed when Barack asked Joe to join the ticket was that Barack made the commitment to get out of the war in Iraq. And, of course, he's done that. And now we're getting out of the war in Afghanistan. So I think that people who are against the war have to feel proud that our president has made that commitment and has kept that commitment. But we have to keep our focus really on supporting the troops while they're there, and we can't forget that. And that's, you know, one of the things that I've tried to achieve through writing the book is create this awareness and ask Americans to commit that while these wars are going on, because this is not going to go away. You know, the wars will end, our soldiers will come back, but they're going to have many problems to deal with for years to come. You know, the wounded warriors and PTSD. But on a more positive note, I'm hoping that in the next couple years that all of this will become a part of our cultures, that schools will be aware of military children in their classrooms, that we'll be aware of what our military is doing. So we won't even have to think about doing all these things for our military, that it will be integrated into our culture and just a part of our daily lives.
Dr. Biden, is this an issue that we've had to deal with again and again? Have we ever treated our returning veterans with dignity and respect that they deserve?
Well, of course, during the Vietnam War, I mean, I lived through that, and I saw how our veterans were treated and when they came back. And, you know, we said in this administration, never again. Never again will our soldiers come back that we won't say thank you for our service and that we'll take care of them. And it's our sacred obligation to take care of the men and women in our military.
Mm-hmm. I know that you are a professor at a community college. I want to talk to you about teaching in a moment, but I'm wondering if you have veterans in your classes.
Oh, yes.
And tell me, are they using the GI Bill to get a college education?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And do they have special, are there special ways that you teach them?
Are there special ways? Well, you know, I'm in the community college, so I'm teaching adults. So there aren't, you know, anything different than I would teach any other student. But certainly I'm sensitive to what they've been through. And you know, if a veteran does not use the GI Bill, him or herself, you know that their children are and spouses are able to use the GI Bill. And one of the things that I'd like to mention about this book is that all the proceeds go towards scholarships for children whose parents are wounded or are our fallen angels.
Hmm. And it's also, we should add, a beautifully illustrated book. Illustrations in a book of this nature are so important, aren't they?
They are. And, you know, the story that I love is that When we were choosing the illustrator for the book, I had Simon & Schuster had given me several examples of illustrators, and I said, you know, this is Natalie's book. She should choose the illustrator. So I scanned the pictures from the books, and I sent them to her, and she chose Raul, and I think that he really sets the perfect tone in the book, and I just love his illustrations, and really I've gotten a lot of positive feedback about the feel of the book.
Raul Colon, yeah, they're beautiful illustrations.
Yes.
And a theme that goes through it, and I'm sure that you've had to deal with this in your own person, is to be brave. Sometimes it's hard to be brave. We have to be brave sometimes.
Yes. And that's the refrain that runs through the book. Be brave, Natalie.
Be brave. Tell me just a little bit about your teaching career. You are teaching actively at a community college. You're also the Second Lady of the United States. You've got a full plate. It indicates to me that teaching is very important in your life.
Well, you know, I've been a teacher now for over 30 years, and right now I'm teaching writing at a community college, and I'm teaching full-time. And when we were elected, I said to Joe, you know, Joe, I can't give up what I love doing, and that's teaching, which, of course, he knew. And he said, no, you shouldn't. You know, you should continue to teach. So 4 days after the inauguration, I was back in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. I have to talk to you about politics. As you know, you're speaking to Wisconsin at this moment, right after a rather a long recall election. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about it, and wondering if your husband considered coming to Wisconsin to campaign for Tom Barrett, if you have considered coming to Wisconsin and will consider it, will be here for the campaign for President Obama and Joe Biden in this fall election.
Well, you know, we were, of course, disappointed in the results of the election. Of course, we had hoped that he would win, but, you know, it didn't work out that way. So I don't know whether Joe had considered coming out. I was working, actually, so, I couldn't get out there, but I'm sure we're going to be in Wisconsin as the campaign rolls along. We're just about to we've been campaigning, but to really go in full force.
And the last question concerning this, as we look ahead to the presidential race, there is a phenomenal amount of money being spent. In Wisconsin, it was $60 million in the recall effort. In the presidential race, it will be so much money. What do you think about the effects of Citizens United? What do you think about money in politics being so exorbitant right now, Dr. Biden?
Well, I'm just really looking forward to the campaign and getting out there and meeting with other American families. And, I've been through 13 campaigns now between my husband and my son.
Oh, my.
So I'm looking forward to being out on the campaign trail, and I hope that I'll get the chance to meet you one day.
Sure. Anytime. The studio's open for you. Please come and visit
us. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Dr. Biden.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Dr. Jill Biden, in a pre-recorded interview, we thought you'd probably want to hear from her. Her children's book is Don't Forget, God Bless Our Troops. Bob Curry joins us now on the Ideas Network. Bob is a combat veteran of Vietnam and Laos, and he was recently honored at the White House in a special ceremony as a champion of change. He has founded these dry hooch gathering places, and they have really grown rapidly. The first one was in Milwaukee on Brady Street, and now I understand they're in Chicago and Madison and other locations as well. And what happens is vets can gather there, family members can gather there, and they can just socialize. There also is a peer mentoring program they can avail themselves of while they are at Dry Hooch. And Bob joins us the last part of our program here. Thank you, Bob, so much for being with us.
Oh, no, thank you for the invitation.
Yeah. How was that White House ceremony, sir?
Very surreal.
I'll bet.
it was unexpected, but it was awesome from the standpoint that, you know, the White House and Washington are at least looking out to other ways of helping veterans, because obviously the ways that have worked in the past, you know, have problems and issues with it. So it was indeed an honor, but, you know, there's a ton of people here who are working on this. So it was a good day.
Mm-hmm. we'll have to have you on for a longer period of time down the road. I know this is brief, but it was right up the alley of what we were talking about the whole hour. So where did you get this idea, and why did you decide that it was necessary to have places like Dry Hooch?
Well, I mean, as a Vietnam vet, like most veterans, you get back and you just want to get on with life. You know, I was 20, 21, and, you know, I was getting married, you know, and then college and kids, and you put all that stuff aside and you just get on. And the Gulf War triggered a lot of my memories and brought them back. And, I became an alcoholic. I started drinking, and, you know, for about 10 years, my life just went down the tubes. And you know, that's another whole story, but in being at the VA and having, it was veterans who reached out to me through my wife and my daughters and gave me help because I had heard of PTSD, but, you know, never, you know, that war was so far in my past, I figured, you know, I just had other issues. And I was at the VA with a bunch of us old-timers, and we're watching the TV set before we go into our group, and Iraq is, you know, Afghanistan started 9/11, you know, was before, and, you know, the build-up for the invasion of Iraq, and we all looked around at each other and said, you know, this generation of veterans deserves better, you know, because we all lost friends, mostly after the war, you know, from suicide or, you know, multiple divorces, you know, drunkenness and stupidity and all those things that surround mental illness and addiction. So that was the inspiration for Dry Hooch. Hooch, well, it's got multiple meanings, so it's memorable, but, you know, Hooch is a place we lived in combat. You know, in Vietnam, we lived in a hooch. World War II, the Marines in the Pacific lived in hooches. And dry means no booze, no alcohol. I mean, no drugs. So we wanted a social space, you know, where people could come in and talk and chat and, you know, not be throwing a book on, hey, here's what issues you have. You know, they can get that from the VA, but we wanted to do it in a safe environment, and hence the coffee house.
And now they're springing up in various locations, aren't they? There's obviously a real need for this, Bob.
Well, I mean, that's the bad news, that the demand out there is more and more and more, but it's a bunch of good people who believe in the mission of Vets Helping Vets, and they want to bring something similar to their community. So, you know, it's a day-to-day struggle. We get, you know, we have one federal program we get funded in Milwaukee that allows us to hire a couple vets to be peer leaders, but then everything is donations. There's no other funding out there for this.
And you're always looking for volunteers, right? Peer mentors are needed. You need people to just help out at the coffee house.
Oh, yeah, and they don't have to be veterans. I mean, family, you know, families get lost in the shuffle, and it's unfortunate because the family's the first one that sees the signs, you know, of a person coming back. The VA won't treat the family, and that's because it's mandated. That's part of the law. So if a family member wants to come into the VA, they can't, but they can come here. So to get back and answer your question, you know, we have, you know, when we were putting up a place, we had drywallers help out who never served, or somebody comes in and, hey, I can serve coffee for a couple hours a week. And that's a more humanistic attitude that, hey, we're all here to help everybody. This is not a for-profit organization where, you know, people are making money and things like that. It's truly people helping people.
Isn't that nice? We're all here to help.
Yes.
I like that philosophy. Do you have a website, or if people want more information? And we'll have you on the air for a full hour down the road, but
sure,
we wanted to have you on today. Is there a site?
Yeah, it's called dryhooch.org, and that's spelled DryHooch .org. And then on that site, if they're in the Madison area, you know, they can click for information on Madison and things like that. So that would be the site to go to.
So you're in Milwaukee, you're in Madison. I read that you're in Chicago, too?
Yeah, we're working with the city of Chicago on getting a location down there. We're hoping on our first location in fall. And we have two locations in Milwaukee, one right across from the VA that we opened up recently, and then the other one on the east side.
Well, you could be everywhere pretty soon.
Well, I mean, anywhere there's a vet and families,
yes,
there's an issue. If it's here, it's everywhere.
Right. Thank you so much, Bob, for being with us. We'll chat longer down the road.
Okay, thank you.
Bob Curry, he has recently, I think it was in May, May 24th, actually, he was honored at the White House as a champion of change. And he was one of 11 individuals within the veterans community, especially those who served in Vietnam, who were honored on that day, honored for showing continued support for efforts to end veterans' homelessness, to boost veterans' employment, treat problems with substance abuse, and develop treatment programs for those dealing with PTSD. If you want more information or if you'd like to help him out in some way, it's a worthwhile cause. He said they need people to pour coffee and help them out. They're expanding everywhere. It's dryhooch.org, dryhooch.org. Well, that was an hour, huh? Thanks to General Colin Powell, to Second Lady Jill Biden, and to Bob Curry for being with us this hour. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. And thanks to Rhonda for on-air production. Thanks to Brett for doing extra production work with the Biden interview. And that's it. We have news coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio, and then we'll turn our attention to, there's so much going on internationally, big elections in Greece, and we will talk about what those mean. Greece keeps surfacing, and that's coming up in just a few moments.